This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 16th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Welcome to this Friday edition of Midori House. We're live from Studio One on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up, we'll hear from the chief Palestinian negotiator, Saeb Erekat, about the violence in Gaza earlier this week and his hopes for peace in the region. And we look at polygamy in Kazakhstan, where some women have decided that one husband just ain't enough. We'll also hear about the art of yoiking in Europe's high north and meet our neighbours in a shop that just sells buttons. And there'll be Monocle music too in the next hour on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. But first, the latest news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. Footage uploaded onto social media websites today have shown hundreds of Syrians marching in anti-government protests. Opposition activists reported continued violence inside the country, saying Syrian forces battled protesters in at least three suburbs of the capital, Damascus. The pictures show protests in the northern city of Idlib, Deraa and Hama, where demonstrators were heard chanting that they would not surrender to the Syrian regime. Some 45 civilians have been killed in the Idlib region in the past day, including 23 whose bodies were found with their hands tied behind their backs, as well as five army deserters. The Afghan President Hamid Karzai has today lashed out at the United States for failing to fully cooperate with an investigation into the massacre of 16 Afghan villagers by a US staff sergeant and questioned whether only one soldier could have been involved. Karzai appeared to back the belief of the villagers and many other Afghans, including the country's parliament, that one gunman acting alone could not have killed so many people and in different locations some distance apart.
The story of the village elders and their fictees is entirely different. They believe it is not possible for one person to do that. In his family, in four rooms, people were killed. Children and women were killed. And then they were all brought together in one room and then put on fire. That one man cannot do.
Egyptians have taken to the streets today to protest at the acquittal of the military doctor who was accused of conducting virginity tests on women. The plaintiff in the case says she will seek justice in international courts. Protester Raza Elwan said she was outraged by the acquittal.
This is a fight for all Egyptians. It's not only about virginity tests. It's about the military rule of the country. We didn't do this. We didn't go through this revolution so that they will take over the country. We went through this revolution and people died because we want our country to be secular. We want freedom for everybody and we want justice for everybody.
Hollywood movie star and human rights activist George Clooney has been arrested at Sudan's embassy in Washington today during a protest against an escalating emergency as the country blocks humanitarian aid from reaching a volatile border region where hundreds of thousands of people are short of food. Clooney, his father Nick and other anti-Sudan activists ignored three police warnings to leave the embassy grounds and were led away to a Secret Service van in handcuffs. Sports news now, and Wales have excluded the quiet confidence of a team who believe they're on the verge of something special throughout a Six Nations Rugby Championship which could culminate in a Grand Slam success in Cardiff tomorrow. Reversing the result of last year's World Cup semi-final defeat by France would give Wales a third Grand Slam in eight seasons. If they do beat a side who have looked jaded after running New Zealand desperately close in the World Cup final, the feeling in the Principality that anything in international rugby is now possible will be confirmed. The Welsh attack coach Rob Howley said a Welsh victory over France would be due to the youthfulness of the team.
You know, you look back at 2008 and it's probably the average age of that team, that experience that had. I think the experience that we've got, the foundation of our side in terms of the front row of Matthew, Adam and Gethin and elsewhere. Obviously got Mike at nine who played and Ian Evans who played. Got experience and we've got the new kids on the block and it's important that we go out and play.
And finally, few eulogies celebrate the sheer hideousness of the recently departed. An exception is likely to be made, however, for Yoda, the world's ugliest dog. The Chinese crested and Chihuahua crossbreed has died in her sleep at the age of 15. Last June, she won the world's ugliest dog contest, a prize awarded annually to raise awareness of the dangers of inbreeding in Sonoma, California. Her owner had adopted her after finding her abandoned behind an apartment building. He initially mistook the puppy as a rat. Her wonky eyes, bat-like ears, protruding tongue and spidery legs helped make her an internet sensation. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. I did see a picture of that dog. It wasn't pretty.
I love my funny stories at the end.
You do like an animal story, and I think you've got another animal story there for me. Have you? Is that you're just pointing out that sad rabbit? We had that story earlier this week.
We've got another story actually about Dustin Hoffman film that called Luck.
You can tell me that one because the rabbit with no ears that got run over.
Well,
by
yeah, you know about that one, but the film called Luck, this lavish TV drama, has run out of luck after three horses have died. At different times, of course, but the critically acclaimed series broadcast by HBO and in its second series has been cancelled after three thoroughbreds died. On Tuesday, a five-year-old filly, Real Awesome, was put down after it reared, hit and fell and hit its head at the Santa Anita Park racecourse. During the first season, two retired racehorses died on separate occasions after breaking their legs.
So they've had Jonathan, you normally cheer us up with your stories. I was kind of all ready to smile. Now you've made us all a bit miserable.
Rob Bound was quite surprised by that story. I told him earlier. I said, have you heard about this story? He said,
you're having a bit of a dark day, I think.
I don't know what it is, Rob.
And the other thing, we're going to go to the weather later on because I'm going to do some headlines first. But I can tell that it's chilly outside because you've ditched the polo shirt, which was the first sign of summer. You've put it back in the wardrobe.
Well, the problem yesterday was it was very cold. First thing in the morning, I thought I'd be brave and wear this T-shirt. By lunchtime, it was warm. So I was right, but I should have brought my sweater.
Okay, well, you've gone back to the nice kind of the thicker fabrics.
Wintry stuff, yeah.
Good. Yeah. Well, we're going to quick look at the front pages of the first of the Australian papers. This is what Australia and New Zealand are waking up to today. The Western Australian, the Weekend Australian, which is the newspaper out of Western Australia, but it has a story about the Reinhardt family. Now, we have been covering this on and off because Gina Reinhardt is a very powerful woman in Australia, the richest woman in Australia, and she's made her fortune from the resources boom. But she has she's been involved in a kind of not very seemly kind of battle with her children over a trust, and the Weekend Australian says that they've spoken to her son, John Hancock, who is in Hong Kong, speaking to legal people and money people about how he extends his battle against his mother. And he says in this interview that it's billed as an exclusive, and I have a surprise in store for them all when I get home. So watch out, Mum. The Weekend Herald, out of New Zealand, has the tragic story of a fishing trawler that headed out to sea this week with nine people on board, a mixture of fishermen and some passengers, and only one person has survived a tragedy at sea where the boat got pounded by waves. And they have an interview with the sole survivor, who's called Dallas Reedy, and he spent 18 hours in icy water. The miracle happened when a petrol container popped up, and he managed to empty the container, and he didn't have a life jacket or anything. He grabbed it and he held on to that, and he managed to hold on to that for 16 hours. He admits that he thought that he was going to die. He says, "I was ready to cross over, and that made me a lot more relaxed. I talked to myself and to my family." The Weekend Press, which is out of Christchurch. Again, another story we've been covering on and off, which is about what to do about the buildings that have been damaged by the earthquake, that were damaged by the earthquake. And obviously we've seen the news that the cathedral there is going to be pulled down. But they're saying, in fact, there are many other buildings, including a famous band rotunda in central Christchurch. And that's also going to be taken down because of earthquake damage. And we also looked this week at a number of people leaving Christchurch permanently and realising they need to go elsewhere for employment and for places to live. So some tough stories there. Mm. We haven't cheered people up yet.
Not really.
But I've got some good things coming your way.
Oh, good.
Like, including women in Kazakhstan with lots of men. So stay with me. But first of all, it's time for the weather with Mr. Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather in association with Kuoni Travel.
Central Europe will be warming up significantly over the weekend. Sunshine and temperatures of around 16 to 19 degrees in Hungary, the Czech Republic and Poland. Unfortunately, though, in the west of Europe, where it's been warm and sunny lately, colder and wetter over the next couple of days. That's just how the jet stream goes. So here's the weekend city outlook. In London, 11 degrees, often cloudy with rain. In Zurich, rain by Sunday, 12 degrees. Warsaw, 16 and sunny. But if you're in Budapest, 19 Celsius with sunny skies, so very warm here. North America and the eastern two-thirds of the United States, temperatures have been so high that it feels more like mid-May. It's been over 20 degrees in places where it should be more like 10 Celsius. Even across the Dakotas in the north, 26 this weekend. More of this to come next week. Meanwhile, the Pacific coast is cool, wet and windy. So on to the weekend city outlook. Boston, 18 degrees by Sunday and it's sunny. Chicago, 24 with sunshine. Washington, D.C., 22, partly cloudy. And in Seattle on the Pacific side, only 6 and it's raining. And around the world the next few days, the state of Western Australia will be impacted by a powerful cyclone this weekend. It'll hit the tropics and bring considerable damage to the region. Perth, which is way to the south, will be sunny with highs of 30 degrees. Hong Kong, warm and sunny here as well, around 26 degrees. And if you're in Tokyo, a rainy weekend and it's only 13. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Tomas, for that. Now, earlier this week saw an outbreak of violence in Israel and in the Gaza Strip after the assassination of a Palestinian militant in Gaza City. Following appeals from world powers, a ceasefire was brokered on Tuesday after 4 days of violence. 25 Palestinians had been killed and 200 rockets were fired at Israel. But will the truce hold? And what are the hopes for peace in the region? Earlier, Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, spoke to the chief Palestinian negotiator, Saeb Erekat, about Tuesday's truce, the role of the Arab Spring in his region's conflict, and his hopes for Palestine.
We are sitting in a pressure cooker situation, and as long as the current situation continues, I'm afraid that things will always continue to be fragile. That's why we have been attempting to achieve national Palestinian reconciliation. This was the aim of President Abbas throughout the discussions, is that we should end the division, we should end the coup d'etat in Gaza, we should restore the unity between the West Bank and Gaza on the basis of one authority, one gun, the rule of law, the peace process. This government of Israel is really trying to push the responsibility of Gaza to Egypt. Now we are trying to manage the situation by sustaining the calm, by to have a full cessation of violence by both sides. And we hope to succeed with this. We hope to succeed because this is the only instrument of management we have now. So but the real solution requires, you know, national reconciliation.
So tell me about the role of Egypt. A ceasefire, a truce was brokered between both sides on Tuesday. Was Egypt critical to that truce?
Egypt played a cardinal role. They're the ones who sustain it. Without them, it would have been impossible.
And has it made any difference that they have a new regime there?
On the contrary, interests don't change with the governments. Egypt, you know, Gaza will always border Egypt, and Egypt's stability requires stable Gaza and Palestine and peace. And this is why Egypt, whether under Mubarak or under the revolution, has done nothing but to exert every possible effort in order to maintain the ceasefire.
So can you tell me about the Arab Spring? I mean, what you've seen is revolutions happening around Palestine and Gaza. Has this taken the focus away from the problems there? Has this been bad for your peace process?
I really believe that the Arab Spring, what's happening in the Arab world, is the most important development that happened to Arabs in the last 1,000 years. If we want to take it to stability and to prosperity and to peace, two elements are needed. One is democracy in the Arab world. And secondly, we need peace between Palestinians and Israelis. These are the two ingredients that go parallel. One cannot be sustained without the other.
Can I ask you about the role of Syria? When we've seen President Assad, he sort of created this idea that he was the defender of the Palestinians. He was hosting Hamas. And this is a very popular thing that he was doing. What's changed now that...
I think the Palestinian question has been used in many occasions and many times by Arab leaders. And what Palestine needs is democracy in the Arab world. What Palestine needs is to preserve the human rights of Arab, of our fellow Arab citizens. What Palestine needs is stability and economic prosperity in the Arab world. So we don't interfere and poke our affairs in the business of Syria or Egypt or Tunisia. We really respect the democratic choice of Arabs. And we believe our Arab brothers and sisters should be given the full chance resort to ballots and not bullets.
What's the peace process looking like now? I mean, we've seen this flare of violence in the last week.
There is no peace process. Unfortunately, the government of Mr. Netanyahu succeeded in derailing the peace process. When they were given the chance between settlements and peace, they chose settlements. That is the truth of the matter. We have done everything humanly possible in order to resume negotiations. But unfortunately, the Israeli government have made sure that the settlement activities continue.
And what are the game changers? What do you think the critical issues are that might get you back around the negotiating table?
An Israeli government that will stop settlement activities and accept the two-state solution system. These are not Palestinian conditions. These are Israeli obligations. Because there is a simple question. If the government of Israel says they accept the two-state solution, why they are continuing to build settlements in the land of the state of Palestine?
And tell me about unity within Palestine. We've seen something of a reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah. Is this critical to the peace process?
Absolutely. There is no contradiction between the peace process and national reconciliation. If we don't help ourselves, nobody else will help us. And I don't see any reason why shouldn't we do this? And we should not blame it on anybody else but ourselves. If we continue the circumstances, this does not reflect well on the peace process or the two-state solution.
But nevertheless, we've seen 200 rockets fired from Gaza militants into Israel over the past couple of weeks. How do you stop that from happening?
By peace. That's what I said. You know, I think the first thing we need to do is to have reconciliation between the West Bank and Gaza, between Fatah and Hamas, to have one authority, one gun, and the rule of law. And the second thing is to establish peace and to end the Israeli occupation so we can normalize. I don't think violence will serve anybody's purpose. I don't think violence will solve any problems. On the contrary, you know, there were 25 Palestinians killed by Israel in Gaza, mostly women and children. That's very unfortunate. We don't want missiles coming from Gaza into Israel. That's why we work so hard to achieve that and sustain the ceasefire and the tahdiyah. And I think that if we want to normalize the situation, Israel must understand that its occupation must end.
Can you tell me about intermediaries? Who are the main game changers and the significant players in the peace process, should there be one? How are the United States involved? How is the UK, France, EU?
I'll be very frank with you. I think decisions are required from Palestinians and Israelis. I don't think Americans, Europeans, Arabs, Russians, UN, Chinese will make decisions for Palestinians and Israelis. Palestinians and Israelis will need America and Europe and China and Russia and the Arabs and Latin America and Africa and Asia to work so hard with us in order to implement the agreement and to sustain peace. But making the decisions and the requirements of peace, I think it's an Israeli-Palestinian matter.
What do you think needs to change in order to get back round the negotiating table? And you've talked about Netanyahu's government being the main impediment. Are there any other things that could change in the region or could change from your perspective?
I want you to call Mr. Netanyahu and ask him one simple question. Do you recognize the state of Palestine to live in peace and security instead of the 67 lines? They don't answer. They're still building settlements on the land of the state. And that's the real obstacle. It's not that you want to make parity between Palestinians and Israelis. For God's sakes, we're under their occupation. And it is the fait accompli policies of Israel that's destroying the prospects of two-state solution.
I mean, you've been a negotiator for decades, and you've talked to me before about, you know, being around the table with the same people for years and actually developing a bond with those people, a friendship with those people. Does that friendship still stand?
I do maintain some relations from my Israeli colleagues in the negotiating table. With some I do, with some I don't. It's just the normal things in life.
We've talked about peace beyond reconciliation. What's your vision for Palestine in terms of infrastructure, even tourism?
In our desire to achieve independence, and once Palestine is restored to the political map and the geographic map, I'm sure Palestine will be a story of prosperity, a story of reconciliation, a story of coexistence, a story where all people will feel home.
And that was Saeb Erekat, the chief Palestinian negotiator, talking to senior editor Sophie Grove. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
with a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, polygamy has become increasingly popular in the southern Stans. But unlike in other parts of the region, in Kazakhstan, it's women who are choosing to take a second husband. One Almaty dating agency has reported a string of successful women coming in to pick a second partner, often with the first worn-out one in tow. And there's no shortage of men who are willing to audition for the role. Cynthia Werner works at the Department of Anthropology at Texas and A&M University, but she spent time in the country as a researcher, and she joins us on the line to explain the Kazakh dating game. Cynthia, first of all, why is this happening in Kazakhstan?
It's a very interesting phenomenon. I'm not exactly sure why it's happening, but I have some theories or ideas. I think, first of all, it's important to note that men are also pursuing multiple partners as well as multiple marriages. And my thought about why women might be doing this is that it's a way to publicly challenge the continuous efforts by some Kazakh men to legalize multiple marriages for men. And then another thought is that it might be a way to make the practice more legitimate by using the concept of marriage rather than just discussing it as a woman having an affair.
Now, why
a society where there would be less tolerant for a woman to have an affair outside of marriage?
And why, if just taking a step back then, so it's happened for men there. Is it because many people there are Muslim, or is it just a kind of a quirk of the region?
I think it does have something to do with the fact that men are that they're all Muslim. Polygamy has been illegal since the early years of the Soviet state, and it's continued to be illegal. But at the same time, there is kind of some continuity in that some men did have multiple partners. And then in the post-Soviet period, there have been continuous political discussions about whether men should be allowed to have more than one wife.
Now,
and so far, no laws have changed, but there's discussions about it that have gone on at the parliamentary level.
Now, the dating agencies who've been quoted talking about this phenomena, they're saying that it's very successful women coming into the dating agencies who are looking for a second partner. Is Kazakhstan, does it have a successful tier of women business people? Is it a very matriarchal society?
I wouldn't necessarily call it a matriarchal society or suggest that it's a place where, like, women who are searching for a feminist utopia should pack up their bags and move to. But at the same time, the economy in general is growing and it's stable, and there are some successful female entrepreneurs. I'd say there's more successful male entrepreneurs, but there are opportunities for women to be successful. There's lots of women that have higher education, postgraduate education, and like I said, a lot of women are succeeding economically.
And is in these stands, they're often led by people who have been a bit kind of adventurous with how they reinvent their nations and what their nations stand for and passed all sorts of laws. And Kazakhstan isn't on the extreme end of that, but it certainly has its few quirks. Do you think that this has allowed the society to develop in a kind of, you know, a more unusual way and to allow quirks like this female polygamy to take place?
That's a good question. Like I said before, there have been discussions about reversing the law on polygamy. It's come up in Parliament at least two times, and the law on polygamy has been changed a bit. It's been decriminalized. So before, there were penalties for been involved in polygamous marriages, and now that's not the case since 1998. So in terms of the quirkiness, I'm just wondering if women are fighting back this effort by some men to keep bringing up polygamy as a possibility, if this is a way that some women are saying, let's do this too.
And Cynthia, when you lived in Kazakhstan, did you come across women who were taking two partners, and or did you notice this desire to kind of challenge the orthodoxy amongst the women you knew there?
Actually, I did not. I knew women who were having, like, say, premarital sex, but I don't know of women who were having extramarital sex. And what I think is especially interesting is that they're referring to this as marriage. It's not just women saying that they're having affairs or taking on as a partner. It's women who are saying they're having marriages. So what does that marriage mean to them, I think, is a really interesting question to ask.
Well, I think
clearly they're not legal marriages.
No, I think the term husband is being... The term husband is being a bit kind of wildly used here, but it's interesting that the dating agencies are saying that they're seeing an increasing number of women come in, and they tend to bring in their first husbands as well to help them kind of pick the who's going to be next. And they're saying that most of the husbands look a bit worn out.
The reference. That brings some level of acceptability to it if their husband's coming into the dating agency. And I'm wondering if it's just the husband that knows that the woman's doing this, or is there a greater level of tolerance at the social level? It's something that I would say, based on my knowledge of Kazakh culture, would not be considered to be tolerable. So I'm wondering whether they're using the term marriage and husband as a way to make it seem more acceptable.
Well, we'll send a reporter there to find out. Our Sophie Grove is very good at investigating these key issues. But Cynthia Werner from the Department of Anthropology at Texas A&M University, thank you very much for joining us. And you're listening to Midori House. And now it's time for some music for our friends in Almaty. This is Grace Jones with I Need a Man. That was Grace Jones and I Need a Man. You're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, we have Buttons, Yoiking and a spot of publishing. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. Footage uploaded onto social media websites today have shown hundreds of Syrians marching in anti-government protests. Opposition activists reported continued violence inside the country, saying Syrian forces battled protesters in at least three suburbs of the capital, Damascus, and there were also protests in the northern cities of Idlib, Deraa and Hama. The Afghan President Hamid Karzai has today lashed out at the United States for failing to fully cooperate with an investigation into the massacre of 16 Afghan villagers by a US staff sergeant, and he questioned whether only one soldier could have been involved. Egyptians have taken to the streets today to protest at the acquittal of the military doctor who was accused of conducting virginity tests on women. The plaintiff in the case says she will seek justice in the international courts. The Hollywood movie star and human rights activist George Clooney has been arrested at Sudan's embassy in Washington today during a protest against an escalating emergency as the country blocks humanitarian aid from reaching a volatile border region where hundreds of thousands of people are short of food. And finally, Wales believe they're on the verge of something special throughout a Six Nations rugby championship, which will culminate in a Grand Slam success in Cardiff tomorrow against France if they can beat them. If they can reverse the result of last year's World Cup semi-final defeat by France, it would give Wales a third Grand Slam in just 8 seasons. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's 18:31 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. I'm now going to be joined in the studio by Monocle's Director of Photography, Poppy Shibamoto, to look at the new issue of Monocle that's on newsstands this week, and in particular, our cover feature on the Sami people. But first, to set the scene, we're going to hear a snippet of Sophie Grove's interview with the eminent Sami songstress, Mari Boyne. And she started by asking her why she started writing music in Sami.
I started first after I finished the teacher's training college. I started to sing just for fun and just, yeah, we made a group, a band, and then we were first singing in Norwegian and English and Swedish, and not at all in Sami. Then after 1 year, I wrote my first lyrics to John Lennon's Working Class Hero. And after that, there was a, how do you say, an avalanche of songs coming. I started to write songs as a therapy for myself, because I saw that me and a lot of other Samis, we felt ashamed of our culture. And I started to question all these things. Why? What does this come from? And then some of my songs were very angry, because when I learned the history of my people, I realized what had happened.
And tell me, what is the Sami language like to write with and work with? It's quite a poetic language that you can, you know, articulate certain things that maybe you couldn't in Norwegian. Do you think that it really lends itself to song?
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful language to sing. The sound of it is really beautiful, and it's poetic, and there are so many beautiful nuances in the language, and it's also a very flexible language, so you can play with the words and turn them. Like, it's easy to work with.
And you travel quite a bit, and you mentioned a sort of collaboration or sort of identification with other indigenous groups. Do you find that when you go to, you know, somewhere that has a similar story to Sami's, that you really have an audience, a receptive audience, and things to share?
Yes, last year in October I was in Guatemala and Mexico, and especially in Guatemala I find that there is a strong connection. What I was impressed by is that they have still the old rituals, what we have lost. So I feel there are similarities, but also it's not like because you are indigenous you immediately communicate. That's a myth. But there are similarities.
And the Sami people now have their own parliament in Norway, Finland and Sweden. Do you think that they are an example to other indigenous people, you know, kind of inspiration of what representation they might be able to get for themselves?
Yes, I think what we have achieved, even if we sometimes feel it goes too slowly, then compared to other indigenous people in the world, what we have achieved here is much, much more than, for example, in Guatemala. So I think that the Sami people have a very important role in the indigenous world and in indigenous politics.
Do you think there's a Sami cultural revival going on? I mean, I've met so many young people doing things. Do you think that the younger generation are engaging with Sami like never before?
Yeah, it looks like us, especially when you see in music, there are a lot of new bands and a lot of young people who are making music and mixing the traditional with the modern. It's also, the young people are also very influenced by what the commercial world and the commercial culture. Well, as I said earlier, that what is the good thing is that I can feel that there is the people are proud, the children. It's so much more natural to speak in Sami, to express themselves in Sami, also through music. So this is encouraging. So I I choose to be optimistic.
And that was our Sophie Grove talking to Murray Boyne, who is literally, she is a rock star, as it were, of the High North. In the polar regions, there is nobody bigger than Murray Boyne. That's true. And in Midori House, there's nobody bigger. Well, maybe there's someone bigger, but there's no one as good as Poppy Shibamoto, who's come to join us.
Hi.
Our photo director. Now, you got to go with Sophie Grove to the High North, didn't you?
Yeah, she went fast and I kind of picked up her luggage that airline left and then, yeah, delivered her all the knickers.
You delivered. Was she pants free up there then?
Well, that's what I thought. But then by the time I got there, she got this really nice, is it alapaca maize? Leggings. So she looked sexy as usual.
As usual. Because we must say that our photographers mainly take pictures of her when she's travelling. But anyway.
Exactly.
Now, you went there for the expo, but also to help kind of make sure that we got a cover out of this story. First of all, was it just really difficult working there with a photographer in that kind of temperature when it's so cold and so snowy?
I think we had, once you get inside, it's really warm. All the houses and hotels everywhere we went was warm. So as long as we are not out for long, it's all right. And then also our taxi driver was telling us the week before we went, it was minus 40 degrees. So that then was really cold. But the time we went was minus 17 at night. So it was all right. I didn't feel that cold. I actually didn't feel as cold as London. But,
and was it still incredibly dark? Was there a kind of a short time in which you could shoot?
Exactly. It was the sunrise was getting early every day by like 20 minutes. I think it was 7:30 to 8 o'clock for sunrise and it went down by 3:30 or 4. So it's not too bad.
But, so by 3:30 or 4 you were in the pub?
Yeah.
Well, you were in
eating
Sophie.
Eating reindeer.
And how, you know, the pictures are extraordinary. So the people... You know, they have amazing, amazing national dress, which they are very fond of wearing, whatever generation. They seem to be very, as we just heard with Murray Boyne, they're very keen to keep their traditions and their culture alive. Were you surprised at how kind of authentic it really was that when you got there?
Yes, and then also it doesn't, is. I know it's not like a fashion or style thing, but it's so bright and it's really nice colour combinations as well. And every region of Sami, they have different colour combinations, they have different hats. And our press person at the Norwegian side of the Sami embassy, he could tell us this person is from that side, this person was married to the Swedish guy, that's why she's got this hat on, or, you know, sort of different regions has completely different things. But it's just all together, it still looks beautiful. Yeah.
Now, did you get a sense of them mixing the kind of their cultures up? Because these people are not kind of poor, and they're not kind of completely cut off from the world. Mm. They obviously know lots of different things that are happening in the rest of the region. But how kind of separated did it feel, do you think, from the rest of kind of the Scandinavian region? Or when you were there, you know, were you flicking on the TV and they were watching CNN and they were listening to, as well as their yoiking songs, they were listening to Madonna?
It is strange because. Our hotel, I guess, is a bit different place to be, but, you know, you have, like, American film on with their subtitles on, and then they're dressed like this, and obviously not everyone's dressed like this every day, but then they have these high-tech things going on as well, this reindeer harness having this snowmobile, and then still wearing completely fur coat and hat and boots.
Now, you've brought two pictures down here, and there's one of the whole group of people. What's this photo?
This is a shot in a new embassy of Finnish side of the Sami, and I think it's just a whole delegate. And then that's, you can still see here, is everyone's, not everyone's wearing the exactly same thing, but some are. So I don't think all of them are from the same regions, some are from other regions, and...
And just you imagine the amount of crafts you must keep going just to make all those outfits. It looks extraordinary. Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing picture. And what's the other? This is the cover picture. And who are these? The two people who actually made it onto our cover?
Yes.
They're both Sami from the Norwegian side, or?
Yeah, Norwegian side. And the nice thing about it is, I think, when these traditional clothes, I think it's worn by older generation. It kind of fits, but these two young, good-looking man and woman dresses like this and then still looks sort of up-to-date, and they look really comfortable in it. And
I like the frill on his skirt.
I could totally wear gloves as well.
I'm not sure I could get away with his look, but I do think he looks amazing. Poppy Shibamoto, thank you very much for coming to talk to us about the world of photography in the Sami High North. And just to keep things nice and Sami, we're going to hear a little bit of Mari Boyne now with her song Gula Gula. Mirko Duvo, cuori Duvo, kuula hiena neita kanta, kuula matta rahku hiena, hiena lämmin vuokka jätmi, tam jos kodi hiä cha jätmi, tam jos kodi hiä cha jätmi. And that was the Sami singer Mari Boyne with Gula Gula. It's 1843 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, this weekend, the ICA on the Mall in London will host Publish and Be Damned, a fair for alternative and artsy magazines, pamphlets and publications. From Landfill Editions to Preston Is My Paris and Clod, 50 titles will be showcasing their latest offerings for the publishing world. And I'm joined in the studio by Kit Hammonds, who's one of the founders of Publish and Be Damned. So just tell me, what, first of all, Publish and Be Damned is the fair, is it? That's the...
Well, it's actually a broader organisation than that, based around the idea of publishers who will never make any money out of producing their print. There was a very strong and vibrant publishing scene that I identified with one of the other founders in 2004, and there really wasn't any way for people to distribute these kind of magazines through traditional methods of bookshops, and it was prior to online trading.
Now, the first thing I love about this fair is the fact that actually people do want to print things and put things on paper and make things and stitch things and staple things. Are you surprised at the vibrancy of that culture that, you know, in this time when we're told that everyone's going over to digital, all these people could have made a little app, or they could have made something you could look at online, but they have a passion for paper?
Well, I think that's really the point of why we set up Publish and Be Damned, was that it was in 2004, that was the moment before the possibility of PDF publishing had really taken over, but it was clearly on the horizon. And to be honest, we thought it was like a death knell, if you like, or a celebration of a final end of print. But actually what seems to have occurred is through social media, social networks, that actually there's been more print produced. People are able to distribute it more, and also, people start to build events and social structures around their publications, which is really the core of what we look at in everything that we do.
Now, we use the term alternative there in the introduction, and alternative can cover anything these days. What do you think is the community that comes to the publishing like this? Who are the people who are trying to find voice through these pamphlets and through these independent publications?
Well, I'm not sure that the participants would want me to say this, but it's really the oddballs that we're trying to identify. Okay. The people who can't fit in anywhere else. And although many of the people who are publishing have quite successful artistic practices within a traditional sort of sculptural or painting setting, what the publishing represents within their practices is a conversation that they have with their peers, an ability to sort of do something different, which isn't bound by traditional sort of expectations of a commercial gallery expectation.
To get into your group and to show in an exhibition like or an event like this, is there any kind of rules and regulations? Do they have to kind of, you know, say that they're not making any money? Do they have to be, you know, only publishing a few hundred of each magazine?
There's no rule. It's more of a rule of thumb, if you like, okay. That we try to concentrate on people who are publishing regular journals. So it's more magazines and fanzines, journals or periodical publishing. And in that sense, that it's not individual artists presenting their work within a book format, but that the magazines themselves are a space for lots of different things to take place. But it's a grey area around the edge of that, because we look for, as I said, the oddballs.
And the print runs of these people, is it from, you know, the tens to the hundreds?
Yes, very much so. I mean, people do print longer runs, but then they find it difficult to distribute them, which is where, again, the fair started, was really this problem of one could print, but find the money to print. But how do you get rid of them once you've got them?
Now, without you getting you into trouble, just tell me one or two of the publications that you think are particularly interesting.
Well, within the fair, I think one of the old classics that we have is a magazine called Control, which is in an issue about 16 or 17, but it's been published since the 60s, so it comes out once every 3 years, with an artist called Stephen Willett, who actually has his studio just round the corner from this studio. And he's a very interesting artist, been working over a long period of time, very involved in sort of social issues. And the magazine is called Control because it's about taking control over one's own art activity. At the opposite end of the scale, you mentioned Preston Is My Paris, is one of my favourites, which is now much more traditional in it looks like a magazine and they do editions, but started the first time we presented it in our fair a few years ago, it was a single sheet of A4 photocopied with a picture and a very small piece of text. And so it's a very broad spread.
And is the title descriptive of what's in that magazine? So Preston, for listeners around the world, is a kind of northern industrial town, and is it a celebration of the town, or is it a celebration of a person called Preston?
No, it was a celebration of the town, very much a kind of parodic celebration of the town, I think. It was loving, but not necessarily without irony.
And you said that this has remained a kind of a vibrant corner of publishing. Do you think that actually, in the time when everything is digital, that people find going to print actually a bit more revolutionary in a way? That doing something on paper feels a bit more old school, and that you can say something a bit different when everyone else is rushing to digital?
I think there's that, but there's also a case of one comes across it differently in a browsing sense. I think it's people who believe that you can move from one thing to another without the need for a Google search, which is based around language, you know, and keywords, that actually coming across something you would never expect and is actually something that's not facilitated online, strangely, that there's a huge amount of information out there, but it's channeled through the words that people use. And so within a bookshop, you might pick up Jane Austen next to automobile mechanics, and that kind of clash of material is really, I think, what people involved in publishing now respond to.
And how do these people get their magazines out to anybody? How do they find an audience for them? Where you're holding the event, the Institute of Contemporary Art is well known for having its little bookshop and magazine collection. Mm. But how do they find an audience? It's great to make Paris Is My Preston Is My Paris, for example. But then, how does he or she then find an audience for that?
Well, again, I think it's really a lot of it's to do with communicating with peer groups. So actually Publishing Me Damned is one of the tools, which is as much about bringing together all these publishers into one space at any one time so that they can have conversations, as it is about promoting to the public, if you like. It's quite like a jumble sale in that sense, that it's built around the idea that a community might recycle and support itself, rather than the idea that we're not the borders of, I presume I can say borders, defunct these
they've
days.
Gone now.
But yeah, exactly. But it's not that kind of, it's not about selling and trying to find a market and catering to a market that's defined through advertising, etc.
And that's the amazing thing, in a way, that you've survived where the borders have come and gone, that your model, or someone from the 60s has been making the same magazine all that time, every 3 years, and has managed to have that longevity.
Yeah, it's a stubborn activity, definitely.
Good. Well, Kit Hammonds of Publish and Be Damned, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew, and we're going to be back to meet the neighbours right after this.
This is Monocle 24.
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 Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Every week at Monocle, we like to go out and meet our neighbours to get to know some of the thriving local businesses that surround Midori House here in Marylebone. This week, we went to the Button Queen, where you can find, you guessed it, lots of buttons. The traditional shop has many clients, from department stores to Japanese tourists. And we spoke to the owner, Martin Frith.
I'm Martin Frith. I'm the proprietor of the Button Queen shop in Marylebone Lane. We have moved from 19 Marylebone Lane, which was now part of the redevelopment of the what's known as the Triangle Project. The Howard Walden Estates wanted to keep us within the family, as it were, so they made available for us the 76 Marylebone Lane, which was quite close by, which was wonderful because it meant that we had an enormous stock, but we were able to transpose it over to the new premises almost a box at a time. And we estimate that by the time we'd finished, we had transferred somewhere in the order of 3 million buttons. But we have been trading as the Button Queen in Marylebone Lane for close on 40 years, because we were in St. Christopher's Place prior to that. So, you know, we've been around a long time. Our customers range across the entire spectrum. Anybody that uses a button. There are some people that are button phobics, canopophobia as it's known, that will not use a button. I've had people stand on the other side of the street while people at their other family members have come in. But apart from that, yes, everybody and anybody, whether it's to replace a missing button from a cardigan, or they will buy a cardigan or a dress and customise it by changing the buttons, something a little more special. You can transform a garment, you know, into something completely different. People don't appreciate how much you can change the look of a garment by purely just changing the buttons. And we have as many people that will buy in Oxfam as will buy in Oxford Street to, and then come change the buttons. You know, not everybody wants Yves Saint Laurent or Chanel plastered all over them. Why should they give free advertising? There are people that will want to work the other way. They will buy an Oxfam and want to do a Chanel look button. So, you know, we try and cater to all tastes. Because our clientele is so extensive, it's difficult to say, well, you know, we sell more of these than something else. I mean, we sell a lot of blazer buttons. We sell a great number of shirt buttons. And we carry pearl and horn and dyed buttons. We are able to have buttons dyed to match fabrics. We've just managed to live through London Fashion Week and all of the trials and tribulations that throws up. Everybody wanting things in a hurry, in a panic usually. So, you know, we also, another element of our business is the stage, film. It's quite amusing. At the moment, we have quite a number of Japanese tourists over, armed with newly published guidebook for London, which gives us a mention and talks about the Harry Potter buttons. So we have Japanese tourists coming in and asking to see the Harry Potter button. But as I explained to them, that there were 7 films and a great number of characters in each film, we did quite a lot of buttons for a number of the films. So, you know, we try and show a few of the buttons that I can remember. Some of them go back a long way now.
That was very nice, wasn't it? That was Martin Frith, the owner of the Button Queen.
LDNTYO NYC MT4.
What I liked about that report was, how can you get the sound of a button? That must have been a challenge for our friend Fernando, who went out to make that report. And he had to think, how do I get the sound of the button? I could hear the man pouring the buttons in the background. It was good. It was effective. It would have been easier to do a report about zips. That would have been an easier sound effect to get. I won't do the sound effect in the studio because it would involve something to do with my trousers. But I think that was fine reporting. Fine reporting. Now, that's just about all we have time for today. This was the 100th edition of Midori House. A spectacular thing, that is. And today's show was produced by Sophie Grove with great style and ease. And it was researched by Fernando Agosa Pacheco. And our studio manager was the one and only Toby Hammond. The Monocle Daily will be here at 2200 London time to start the day in Asia. But next on Monocle 24, it's The Menu with the wonderful Marcus Hippi. So stay tuned for that. This has been Midori House, and it's been with me, Andrew Tuck. But for now, it's actually time to say goodbye.